This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Despite efforts to preserve endangered animals, trafficking has increased in some parts of the world by an estimated 5,000%, according to conservationists. The poaching is pushing some animals, such as black rhinos and hippos, to the very brink of extinction. 46 countries signed the London Declaration, which works to end wildlife trafficking through law enforcement and cross-country cooperation. U.S. President Barack Obama has an additional national initiative that includes measures such as a ban on trafficked items like elephant tusks. Wildlife trafficking is a multi-billion dollar per year industry that has reportedly been used to fund Al-Qaeda-related groups. What is the scope of the problem and what should be done about it? Three experts join us. David Wilkie is a wildlife ecologist, a professor at Boston College, and the director of conservation support at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Tanya Wyatt also joins us. She is a lecturer of wildlife criminology at the University of Northumbria and the author of Green Criminology in Wildlife Trafficking, The Illegal Fur and Falcon Trades in Russia Far East, and Wildlife Trafficking, A Deconstruction of the Crime, the Victims, and the Offenders. Mark Beckoff is with us. He is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with the scope of the problem. David Wilkie, what would you say we're facing?
Humans have been trafficking wildlife for millennia, and it's remarkable. North Americans actually ate passenger pigeons to extinction. There used to be flocks of 3 billion flying overhead, and we ate every single one of them. Well, the challenge is that we're doing this to more and more species as more and more of humanity gets to a level of wealth where we can all afford to buy things. And so tiger bones, tiger skins, leopard skins, rhino horns, elephant teeth are all trinkets that humans want for prestige or for other reasons. And with 7 billion people on the planet, demand for wildlife products is grossly outstripping the ability of wildlife to supply and meet that demand. So we're in a terrible crisis, and we're going to lose many species unless we do something about it.
As I understand it, the numbers are changing quite drastically and have become much worse, particularly with some of the animals, like you mentioned, tigers, rhinos, and elephants. Do you have a sense of how much worse it is?
Well, there's only about 1,600 female tigers left in the wild. That's a startlingly tiny amount. African elephants, we've gone from 1.5 million savanna elephants to around 300,000. We went from 800,000 elephants in the tropical forest of Africa to 80,000. So we've only got 10% of the elephants in the forests of Central Africa that we used to have. An unbelievable crash in the populations. It's very much the same way that whaling went. We lost almost 95% of our whales, and only when we found fossil fuels in Pennsylvania and started replacing whale oil for lamp oil did we actually save the whales. So we've got the ability to change the situation. We just need to have a global commitment to do so. And I think we've actually begun to see a sea change in the attitudes of the global community about wildlife trafficking. And Chelsea Clinton and Secretary Clinton have a huge amount to, we've got a lot to thank them for actually pushing the global agenda on wildlife trafficking.
Tanya Wyatt, what would you add?
Well, I do think you see geographic differences. You have problems of demand in the United States, in the European Union, also in China and other areas in Asia, such as the Southeast. But then you also see, you know, the global South, we could say, as being the areas that are particularly exploited areas, obviously in Africa, South America, and again in Asia, that are targeted for their wildlife as commodities to be sold into more Western or areas that have growing middle class consumers. So there is a regional and geographic aspect to it that we need to take into consideration when we're developing prevention strategies.
Mark Beckoff.
I agree with everything that's been said. I think we need to have extremely strong enforcement of existing regulations, and maybe the existing regulations aren't really strong enough. I'm always amazed at the sheer numbers of animals who are involved. It's staggering when I read the reports of the millions of members of different sorts of species who are involved in the illegal wildlife trade. So it seems to me that enforcement is really important.
When you say millions of species, the ones we hear most about are the tigers, the rhinos, the elephants, the great apes. David Wilkie, I think you've also written about the great apes. Mark Beckoff, what are the other animals?
When I said millions of species, I was really thinking more the sheer number of individuals in a given species. But the exotic birds, for example, and reptiles who can be stuck in suitcases, for example, and you know, people try to smuggle them in. So that's all I was really referring to.
I see.
This is David. I was just out in Cameroon working with some colleagues of mine to think about how we might set up a conservation agenda for African grey parrots. It never occurred to me that African grey parrots are the most valuable pet on the planet. Because every African grey goes for $1,000 to $10,000 a bird. And we know nothing about them. We don't know about their ecology. We don't know where they feed. We don't know how many there are. They're social birds. They groom one another like primates. And yet we know practically nothing about their ecology. And yet they're the single most valuable pet on the planet. Isn't that startling? And I think this speaks to me about what the trade is about. 89% of Chinese consumers of ivory know that ivory consumption requires the death of an elephant. And 85% of those consumers will say they're going to buy ivory again.
Mm-hmm.
If just 10% of Chinese families who make $16,000 or more a year buy 1 2-ounce piece of ivory, that's about the size of a piece of soap that you get in a hotel. That requires 32,600 elephants to die. So the scale of the issue is unbelievable, and yet our ability to, our knowledge of the issue is waning relative to the scale of demand.
Tanya Wyatt, you have been looking at this. You've compared it also to the drug trafficking rings. You say the worst perpetrator is organized crime, but that there are other perpetrators. How would you describe this?
I would say that organized crime might have the largest impact in that they are capable of killing, frankly, more animals than maybe individuals. But you do have all the different levels of people that are actually involved in consumption and involved in demand. So you do have impoverished people that may feel forced to poach or to harvest things illegally. But I'd argue that they're probably having the least amount of impact or killing the least amount of animals. And you do have these larger criminal organizations that may be organized or maybe just structured rather than being our kind of stereotypical mafia kind of organized crime. And those are the kinds of criminals that we need to be worried about because they're the ones that are poaching elephants and rhinos in a very structured and systematic way.
And yet part of it, you mentioned, is also there are all these other actors that are part of the process, states, terrorists, corporations, insurgents. How do you see each of these actors as part of it?
Well, absolutely. It's certainly a long chain of middlemen that it's passing through as well. And states do have a role to play in that. There's arguably corruption is key in facilitating a good deal of wildlife trafficking, which is an area that needs to be studied much more. But corruption of customs, border patrol, police officers, but government officials as well that are facilitating it and profiting from it, that's a big part of it as well. And then there is anecdotal evidence that's becoming more substantiated that terrorists and insurgents are using wildlife, particularly ivory, sometimes timber, as a way to fund their kinds of conflict. And that, too, has a tremendous impact on the survival of these species.
This is David again, I couldn't agree more. I think that the wildlife trade and wildlife trafficking is just one other commodity that's being adopted by organized crime. They traffic arms, they traffic women, they traffic drugs, and now they're just trafficking wildlife. It's just another commodity. But to be honest, I think we've got incredibly powerful tools to tackle that part of the trafficking, the financing of trafficking. U.S. statutes for money laundering are are about 20 years old, and it allows for the Treasury Department, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security to actually forfeit assets of people who we believe have gained these assets illicitly. It doesn't require the conviction of someone. It just requires the assumption that the assets have been obtained illicitly. And I think that asset forfeiture has huge potential for the U.S. and the European Union to take a bite out of crime in many ways.
In terms of the law enforcement side of things, do we know how effective these statutes are? When I worked in the legislature here, one of my first observations was we have good laws in the books, but we don't have them enforced. Is that the same situation here?
That's what I was saying. This is Mark, about enforcement. I agree that holding assets would be a very powerful tool, but it just, I don't know, maybe I'm a skeptic on it. It just seems the corruption is so widespread that that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to enforce already existing regulations or laws.
This is again, David. I would agree with that too. But two colleagues of mine, Sam Strindberg and Fiona Meisel, looked at 10 years of data on the changes in elephant numbers in Central Africa. The results were devastating. It was a huge collapse of elephant populations in Central Africa. And they used really credible data to show that. But the upside of that was they showed that anywhere in Central Africa where rangers were actively patrolling, elephants survived. We know that good and effective ranger patrolling is a hugely successful activity to prevent poachers coming in and whacking elephants for their ivory. Regardless of corruption, it actually works. So we know that ranger patrolling works, and the conservation community has come together and developed this new consortium called SMART, which is to try and roll out the next generation of really clever tools to help eco-guards, rangers, park service people to do patrolling the most effectively as possible. And we've got credible evidence to show that that matters, that it makes a difference. Where rangers are patrolling, elephants survive. Where rangers aren't patrolling, elephants disappear. So, yes, corruption is a huge problem, but we've got some tools that can actually make a difference.
I had read that a lot of technology was being developed in a way that could also aid in the enforcement of these laws, technology that is actually controversial in other ways, such as drones. Is this actually being developed for conservation purposes, or is it just far off into the future? Tanya White?
Andrew Lemieux is another colleague of mine, and I believe that they have been actually testing drones in Uganda, is at least my sense of it. So I do think it's maybe a bit further along than we would have guessed.
This is David again. Yes, UAVs are actually really useful. And to be honest, they're useful for two reasons. UAVs or drones let eco-guards, who are typically far less sophisticated and armed than the poachers who they're against, it lets a ranger patrol figure out whether people that they're hearing at a salt lick, are they hunter-gatherers who've got legitimate reasons to be there, or are they illegal hunters who have got AK-47s and RPGs and could... So drones help rangers save themselves from getting into a firefight and actually getting killed. So I think drones have huge potential to increase the safety of ranger patrolling. And drones also have a huge potential of reaching out, allowing a ranger patrol to patrol a far larger area than they would on foot. And this is particularly important in the forest. So yes, we are actively using drones to extend the reach of eco-guards and to protect eco-guards from bumping into much more seriously armed individuals and much more ruthless individuals who are poaching ivory.
To me, then we're more on the ground, because at the beginning we were talking, you know, just about corruption and enforcement of regulations and holding assets, which I think is really a great idea as well, but I think it's really very difficult to enforce. But I love what you're talking about in terms of local types of control. When I was in Kenya, I mean, I talked to some people, and one of the points they made was, you know, in some ways the people doing this are just trying to survive. And you can pay them to kill animals or you can pay them to protect animals. And it's not that they're nasty people. It's just they're very poor and they need an income. So I'm liking the idea of, you know, acting locally and thinking globally, if you will.
Well, that brings up a case study that Tanya Wyatt did. Tanya, you did this case study about Cambodia and some of the efforts they've made there that seem to have had an element of success.
Well, I think it's similar to what Dr. Wilkie was talking about of NGOs that have been quite progressive and have years ago realized that rangers do make the difference in protecting species. And so I was an intern and have written about Wildlife Alliance, you know, fundraising and paying the salary of rangers to go in and actually do these patrols and protect these areas. And I do think that they've had some success. It's very promising of not only preventing poaching, but then also rescuing animals that have been poached and rehabilitating them and hopefully returning them to their habitats.
It sounded also that there was an education program there in Cambodia that was really teaching people about the ecology and about the need for biodiversity. Was that also part of it?
Yeah, that's a great program that the Wildlife Alliance has developed there, that they have a van that they drive around to the more remote villages throughout southwest Cambodia and really focus on young people and go into the grade schools and to children that are around the age of 6 and 7 and teach them the value of conservation and biodiversity and how we need to protect our environment, which is really the age we need to be targeting to kind of change the entitlement that some people feel to consume wildlife. And so I think it's a great program, and I do think that they're showing some success after years of doing it.
I love the idea of working with youngsters. I think it's really the key, one of the big keys to the future.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about wildlife trafficking, the problem and the potential solutions. David Wilkie?
One of the interesting things is that wildlife trafficking is a destabilizing thing. It's usually outsiders coming in and taking the resources of local people. Local people don't like that. They don't like it because it's their resources. They don't like it because it increases violence and instability and insecurity, and that's not good for development. So one of the neat things that's happening as mobile phone and cell phone coverage extends is we actually have the capacity to have anonymous whistleblowing that allows for local people to say, hey, you know, I've noticed some weird stuff happening in my neighborhood. And to me, this sort of crowdsourced intelligence networks, again, have huge potential to extend the reach of law enforcement. And law enforcement always sounds bad. I think of it as crime prevention. To me, if I say crime prevention, everyone likes it. If you say law enforcement, it sounds more like a fascist state. But crime prevention through crowdsourcing, to me, has huge potential of changing the game. Because local people don't want armed militias coming into their neighborhood and shooting the critters that they could potentially make a profit on through tourism or something else.
One other thing that I saw in one of your papers pertained to really the buyers of certain products. Now, this was specifically, I think, about bushmeat. But you had found that as the prices went up really high, the consumption went down quite a bit. Is there an answer on that side as well?
Well, bushmeat's a necessity for many people. It's a source of dietary protein. So that's different from a luxury good like ivory or rhino horn. So the economics of the trade is fundamentally different. When you drive the price up of a necessity, people will look for a substitute. There is no substitute for rhino horn or elephant ivory, and that's the trick. And that's why ban on sales and burning caches of illicitly harvested ivory is so important. I'm really looking forward to Tanzania burning their 122 tons of ivory. That means that ivory will not leak back into the market. Public crushing or burning of ivory sends a huge message. And I think that the Obama administration, by banning ivory sales effectively in the United States, is going to encourage China and Vietnam, the two largest consumer nations, to think really hard. Do they want to be international citizens? Do they want to be a part of the international community? And it's going to put enormous pressure on those governments to do something about the ivory trade.
Let's take a look at both President Obama's task force and also the London Declaration. Mark Bekoff, have you had some time to digest what has gone on?
Sort of. I did. I think that what has gone on is a really good move in the right direction. And I work in China a bunch with one of the Moon Bear Rescue projects, and I love the people there, but I'm not so optimistic about change there, not because the people are necessarily heartless, but just because the sheer numbers and the sheer money involved. That's what I've heard from people there working in other areas of animal protection, is that it's just so hard to get your foot in the door just because of the numbers and the money.
Tanya Wyatt?
We have followed, I read the National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking coming out of the U.S., and then I was at the International Wildlife Trafficking Symposium that happened before the conference in London, and I'm encouraged that it's on the political agenda and it's finally getting attention that probably the three of us on the panel have been talking about for years. So it is encouraging. I probably would share some colleagues' reservations, though, that I worry that it could go the path of being too militarized and paramilitarized, and we have the same kind of battle that we had with the war on drugs, to where we just throw lots of money and lots of law enforcement at it, and we don't actually make the changes on the ground to provide people with alternative livelihoods and things that need to be done to really stamp out the problem. But hopefully all of that will come into play as well as efforts increase.
So you see part of the missing components as really an economic component for people to have an alternative to this process.
I do, yes. That's how we help local communities to not poach and not harvest things illegally. You've got to tackle demand. Yes, there's crime prevention, but there's also changing the paradigm of how we view wildlife can be consumed. And that's the most challenging task ahead for us.
David Wilkie, how would you assess the international community's efforts?
Now, what I'm absolutely startled is the marvelous mobilization of international interest and support for the ivory trafficking issue. I agree with everyone on the panel that we need to tackle wildlife trafficking. It's a trade good, so we need to tackle it along the commodity chain, from the source points where poaching is happening, to national transit, to international transit, to the consumers. We need to tackle all the way along the supply chain. Absolutely. What we've learned with China is really interesting. We thought that we could use campaigns that have been very successful in the United States and in Europe, using movie stars or sports stars as spokespeople for the trade. When we actually interviewed Chinese ivory consumers, we said, you know, if Yao Ming, this wonderful, really tall basketball player, said, don't buy ivory, would that change your impressions? Would that change your opinions? 3% of ivory consumers said that would change their ivory purchasing behavior. 37%.
That's interesting. Yao Ming is a very strong supporter of the Moon Bear Rescue Program I work with.
And he's fantastic. He's a marvelous advocate.
Yeah.
But 37% of Chinese ivory consumers said if the government banned it, they would stop consuming ivory. 25% said if Politburo members said that it was inappropriate to buy ivory, they would stop buying ivory. I think one of the things we really need to do is understand the consumer, and we're getting a better handle on that, and we're getting to understand how we can use social media, how we can use pressure on the governments to change behavior, and that's a significant difference to 9 months ago.
Mark Bekoff, one of your edited volumes on conservation asked a question in an important way. It said, who lives, who dies, and why? How would you answer that today?
It was in my book, Ignoring Nature No More, The Case for Compassionate Conservation. And there's essays in there that talk about the wildlife trade. I think individuals are making that decision. What they just said, I didn't know those data. And I think about American advertisement, you know, where LeBron James says something and the stock in a company goes either up or down significantly. I didn't know that about China. But I think the people who are making that, answering the question, who dies, who lives, who dies, and why, are really the locals. And that's why, like I said before, I'm not saying much new right now, is getting to them in whatever way. So if they can be influenced by government policy or what Politburo people say, that would be the way I go. But I also don't think that people realize that they are basically making that decision. And that's why, you know, the who dies, who lives, who dies, and why has sort of become my little bumper sticker. And when I talk to people about it in terms of other issues with non-human animals, it actually gives them pause, because that's basically at issue. We are making these decisions about the lives of individual animals.
Tanya Wyatt, one of your studies also looked at how birds are being smuggled in Oceania, going from Australia to New Zealand and then getting trafficked out. Given New Zealand's reputation for actually protecting the environment and other species, does that become part of it? Are countries like Australia and New Zealand then going to have to crack down on this?
They're definitely hugely involved in the international discussion around wildlife trafficking. John Scanlon, the current Secretary General of CITES, is Australian, and those people have been actively involved in it. And New Zealand's an interesting case because they were the first, really, to come up with a wildlife enforcement network. So they were good in predicting that this was going to be an issue. It does obviously come down to funding. They've had trouble maintaining the resources that are going to those units. But I think Australia is actually a good example, because they have much stricter CITES regulations than other countries. And I think that's why, in part, why they've managed to keep their amounts of illegal trade so low. And as I've written in that article, it might be wise for New Zealand possibly to consider having stricter CITES regulations as well, and the UK as well, because it does tend to be a hub here in London for illegal trade.
David Wilkie.
The charismatic species always get the headlines. The pangolins, the seahorses, the sharks, critters that people either think are slimy or unpleasant or dangerous don't get into the headlines. And I would just like listeners to understand that the wildlife trade is rhinos and elephants and tigers, but it's a whole host of other species that are being overexploited, because 7 billion people is a lot of demand. And we can no longer feed off the planet. We can no longer eat off the planet. We can no longer just take what we need. 89% of the terrestrial landscape is dominated by humans. That's a lot. Humanity has to decide if we want to save things or not. And for my children, my children's children, I want elephants to be there. I want rhinos to be there. I want sharks to be there. I want seahorses to be there. I want a future where my great-great-grandchildren get to see what I see. And thus, we need to fix the wildlife trade.
Mark Beckoff.
I agree. I'm so influenced by Ed Wilson. You know, Wilson, he had a great quote about how really ants and the insects are the animals with whom we should be concerned. And since I've studied social carnivores, I mean, I love them and they are charismatic, but he basically really has convinced me that somehow we have to have people become aware of the incredible importance of the non-charismatic animals. And, you know, there's a size thing there, too, because a lot of times they're the ones who can be put into a suitcase. You know, you can't put an elephant into a suitcase, but you can put a lot of little animals into a suitcase or into a backpack and smuggle them. So in my own work, I try to stress that, you know, especially with kids, take them on hikes and take them on walks and have them focus on the little animals who they think are slimy and ugly and, you know, the ones to whom they go, ooh, I wouldn't want that animal around me.
Tanya Wyatt.
No, I would agree with both of them, with Dr. Beckoff and Dr. Wilkie, enthusiastically, that we need to have that shift, that wildlife is not just instrumentally valuable to humans, that it's intrinsically valuable and beautiful and has its own right to life.
Absolutely, Tanya. I couldn't agree more with you.
Thank you for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me to join this conversation.
David Wilkie is a wildlife ecologist, a professor at Boston College, and the director of conservation support at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Tanya Wyatt is a lecturer of wildlife criminology at the University of Northumbria and the author of Green Criminology and Wildlife Trafficking, The Illegal Fur and Falcon Trades in Russia Far East, and Wildlife Trafficking, A Deconstruction of the Crime, the Victims, and the Offenders. Mark Beckoff is professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Also, special thanks to Joe Carman for helping to produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.